Talking Bollocks, a Go Loud original podcast. Sponsored by Right Style Furniture. Right price, right style, right now. Visit rightstyle.ie.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
What you waiting for? Put your back in it. Just a little more. Throw your weight in the ground. Tell your body your head. Walk it hard and long. When you finish that.
The hip knocker.
Are you still sitting on a beanbag and you're sitting in them like you're 17?
Grow up and head to Right Style Furniture. They've got proper, comfy, stylish gear and they're Irish and family run too.
The house packages are class. For just €3,649, you get an electric sofa set, full dining setup and beds with mattresses. That's a serious bang for your buck.
I got my corner sofa off them and I haven't stood up since.
They've got locations in Font Hill, Belgard and now Omni Park. Open every day and late on a Thursday and Friday in Font Hill and Omni.
One stop shop for kitting out the gaff. Don't say we never looked after you.
Exactly. Right price, right style, right now. Visit www.rightstyle.ie and use promo code GET10 for 10% off.
Episode 219, the Talking Bollocks podcast, brought to you by Go Loud. It's me, COB.
It's me, Terry Flower.
Today we're joined by...
me, Sabina Brennan.
Sabina, it's good to have you back. But we were literally just talking about something there before we started.
Yeah.
You've met Woody Harrelson before.
I did.
Where?
In Galway. It was at the Galway Film Flat. It was when I was an actor. So I was...
You used to be an actor?
I did used to be an actor. Do your research, Calvin.
Wind up. I can remember, what was he like?
A bit strange, actually.
Yeah, he comes across as a...
He was... It was really funny, actually. Well, there's two things I remember. One was, so he gave a little workshop for actors, like you had to be a professional actor to be in it. Do you know what I mean? So yes. That it wasn't just random. As it was very, very small, there was maybe 20 people in the room and he basically just talked about acting, but he was up at a table in front of us, about where you are to me is where I was sitting. And the man had a pair of shorts on and he sat up on the table and all I can say is, well, he wasn't wearing a kilt.
You got the full view.
It was just the same.
Right, yeah.
So not only did I meet Woody Harrelson, he also refused to drink when he said, I need water, you know, and someone came with water and he opened it and he went up and he knocked that crap. It was sparkling water.
Legend.
Threw it back at them.
Actually, kill you.
And no, the opposite, kill you.
Yeah.
You won't drink sparkling water, he's right.
Yeah, he wouldn't drink sparkling water and threw it back and got ordinary water. And then I thought it was really funny because then at the flat, there's a place you hang out. Now, this is a long time ago. Place you hang out. And he just hung out with everyone else. But like he was just doped out of his head, smoking dope. And actually at one point he was looking for anyone got a joint. And I'm kind of going, you won't drink sparkling water. But you're smoking the ganja, you know? It was funny. Yeah.
Yeah. He comes across as a bit of a legend now.
Yeah, but his dad. Yeah, I think his
dad was involved in JFK's assassination. His dad's in them vaults.
Is that not like one of those makey up things? I know his dad definitely was in prison.
I'm waiting on a defamation case straight away. It's at the coming in.
Look her up.
Yeah.
Look her up. Woody Harrelson's dad was locked up. He was a hitman for the CIA.
I knew his dad was locked up and I knew he was a murderer, but I don't know whether I heard that and which is a conspiracy theory.
And then supposedly him and Matthew McConaughey might be brothers. They spoke about that.
That's somewhere in the back of my head.
Yeah. And then I also heard that Matthew McConaughey's dad had a heart attack while he was doing the business with his mother. So, you swear I knew the lads, wouldn't you?
And how quick you started this. That's the quickest intro of all.
Because
you mentioned Woody Harrelson and you were starting.
Woody Harrelson is a legend. One of my favourite films ever.
He's a great actor. I won't say he's not, you know.
Yeah.
No. Right, fuck Woody Harrelson. Sabina.
Yes.
You're Calvin. Back.
I'm back. Glad
how long
to be back.
You were here last year?
I think it was last year, actually. You wanted to talk about manifesting and I wasn't allowed to talk about it because my book hadn't come out yet.
That's true.
So I'm happy to talk about manifesting, the neuroscience of manifesting.
So I think we could have mentioned it to you that there's a lot of like early talk around manifesting. Yeah. Do you get that? Do you hear people saying that?
Oh, of course. Yeah. So, manifesting is considered woo, you know, woo-woo, or that it's pseudoscience, that it's not, you know, okay? And there is a lot of that out there, right? But I couldn't help but notice that a lot of the things associated with manifesting, a lot of the techniques and practices are grounded in science.
Sorry, Sabina, can you just give 30-second intro to who you are and what you do, just for people that maybe didn't listen to the first episode.
Absolutely.
Just because I don't want someone to be like, oh, who's your one talking about manifesting? Okay. Very qualified woman sitting in front of us here.
Yeah, especially as I said, I used to be an actor. They'll go, oh, here she is.
Yeah.
She can't act anymore. She's off trying to peddle manifesting. No, quite the reverse. Actually, I left acting to become a psychologist. And for me, they're very similar, acting and psychology. It's about just an interest in what makes people tick, not pick. yes. So, yeah, my name is Sabina Brennan. I am a psychologist and a neuroscientist, and I am a two-time number one bestseller, and third time just was top 10. Got to 5. I was very disappointed. Anyway, yes, look, I kind of know my stuff around neuroscience. And I am known for, we spoke the last time about brain fog and how the brain works. But I'm kind of known for that much more serious side of things, brain health. Excuse me, how to keep your brain healthy, how your brain works, brain fog. And then my next book is even more serious that I've just spent 3 days reading the audio book for, is about caring for someone with dementia. So that's the kind of sphere I'm known for and the kind of research areas that I worked in. So very, very serious stuff, how to reduce your risk of dementia and all those kind of things. So now then, you know, why write a book called The Neuroscience of Manifesting? Like that's like a kind of big jump to the side, especially as a lot of my fellow academics and scientists would completely dismiss it as absolute rubbish, as woo. I kind of wasn't prepared to do that because there's so many bits and pieces, as I was just saying, that are, for example, if I was to, how would I say it? Yeah, manifesting, some of what manifesting is about is very similar, is echoed in CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. I'm sure you've talked about that loads. Mm-hmm. You know, CBT is about helping people understand how your thoughts influence your reality, your perceptions of the world and your behavior. Kind of sound familiar in terms of manifesting. Yeah. But the thing is, when I looked into it, I actually, to be honest, initially when I started out on this book, I wanted to write a book to help people understand how their brains work so they can understand how they work so that they can better attain their potential.
Yeah.
Okay. It fits very nicely kind of in with the manifesting thing in a way. So I decided I'd take a real deep dive into manifesting and I read all the manifesting books. I signed up for newsletters. I listened to people in their talks online, etc. So essentially what I decided to do was weed out the woo.
Yeah.
And get to the core of actually what really works. I didn't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater or throw out what works with the woo. You know, in fairness to academics and people who, serious scientists who do write it off, there is lots of misconceptions and misunderstandings about manifestation out there. The biggest misunderstanding is that it's a passive process, that you just sit there, think about what you want, and then wait
for
it to
happen. And the universe will give it to you.
And the universe will give it to you. My ass. Yeah. The universe is not going to give you anything.
Yeah.
In fact, actually, that's another thing that really annoys me about it, about that kind of misconception around it is, oh, the universe will provide. You're giving the power to the universe.
Yes.
My argument is there is absolutely no need to do that because the power lies within.
Yeah.
It lies within you. And very specifically, it lies within your brain. So basically, kind of, that's one of the very first things. So the introduction to my book is actually much longer than you would normally expect in a book because I wanted to deal with all those kind of elephants in the room first before I got into the core of it. So manifesting is not a passive process. It takes action.
Sabina, real quick.
Yeah.
See the way you're saying to so many academics that just wouldn't even look at it.
Yeah.
What made you want to just do that deep dive into it to try and find out more? Where?
Because I'm in the business of trying to help people help themselves and achieve their dreams, their goals or whatever.
Yeah.
And that's what a lot of manifesting gurus or people who write about it are trying to do. We're both trying to help people, but we go about it in different ways. I had two, there's a couple of reasons, I suppose, as well. On top of that is I do think there's charlatans out there. I think there's people who charge people a lot of money for snake oil, you know, stuff that doesn't work. My argument is you don't have to pay someone 500 euro for a one-to-one session. Yes, my book costs money, but you can get it in the library if you want. The power lies within you. If you understand yourself, you don't need to pay that. I'll probably be shot if people read this, but that's the truth of it. The thing is as well, what neuroscience tells us is that some people, we all evolved to sort of believe in the supernatural in a way, right? Our brain makes up stories to explain things that happen that we don't understand. Yeah. But some of us tend towards more logic and rational explanations. Other people are more inclined to believe those stories. And what the research shows is those who are more inclined to believe that are also more likely to be victims of fraud. And that's kind of something that really, really bothered me. So essentially, I wanted to weed out that woo and sort of say to people, look, you know, visualization works, affirmations work, you know, and go into more detail on that. For those, I also felt that there is a lot of people who would come from a science background or a rational background. I'm not talking about academics. I'm talking about everyday people who say, well, what's the science behind that? I want to understand why that works. Who really would love to manifest their dreams, but aren't following any of those tips and techniques because they've written it all off as woo. So they were kind of the two audience I had in mind, you know, to kind of make it accessible. And basically, what I did, I suppose, in a sense, is I drill down through everything I read and then linked things. And that is what I was finding, you know, when I was kind of reading stuff before I decided to write the book, I'd say, aperture, that's just X, Y, Z, or that can be explained, or no. So one other myth that I had to kind of bust in a way is, and I do like the idea. I mean, I'm sure you've heard of the law of attraction. You know, what you put out comes back to you. It's kind of close to karma. I like that idea. And I like it in the sense of if you're kind to someone, someone will be kind to you. And actually being kind to someone makes someone else, a third party watching you be kind to me, makes them more likely to be kind. That's kind of passing things around and on. But the law of attraction, first of all, it's a misnomer. Anything to be called a law has to go through
constant.
And it has to go through scientific, you know, theories and tests and get. So there is no scientific law of attraction. Okay.
Sabina, can I stop you?
Itching, I am.
We spoke about this during lockdown. Was it during lockdown?
Oh, you're about 3 years too late with this podcast, honestly.
We spoke about this a few years ago. And I remember, I think that's the first time we ever got a book or a hate online.
Really?
Someone only texted me the other day, and it was a name I wasn't familiar with. And I can't remember what it was about, but they clicked in and the message above it is me and them having an argument about this topic. And I was like, that was years ago.
Like, there was a lot of, like, people coming at us saying, yes, don't know what you're fucking talking about. The law of attraction is real. And and we were like, because I remember everything, but you were a little bit more frustrated than me.
I was annoyed.
Because you're at the main just explaining people who are like very fucking, they need facts and facts-based people, and he's really one of them.
Yeah.
You know, and I remember he was frustrated at the time, and it was a conversation that we had been like, the law of attraction, like blah, blah, blah. Yeah. The hate we got. Yeah. Saying that that's not real.
No, I can imagine, and I'll put my armor on. But actually, you know what? I'm just in the business of you know, showing what neuroscience tells us, you know, about these things. So the law of attraction, it's a lovely idea in the sense of what I was talking about. Mm. You know, you get back what you put out. That's nice. But thinking about something, and I think I've read about it, you know, whereby the law of attraction states that, and it's sort of what I call misrepresenting science, saying that, and it's invoking quantum mechanics inappropriately. So basically, it's like saying, you know, everything vibrates at a certain level. Yes, it does in the quantum world, but we actually belong in the classical world of physics.
Literally, it's mad because I'm holding myself back and being like, I told you so. Only thought you're the qualified person here. These are the things we were saying. Like, the one thing I had a problem with.
You have to read my book.
I had a problem with the term law of attraction. Because there's the law of gravity.
There's actually very few Laws,
yeah.
But you know, there's very few laws in physics because...
And science, yeah.
Yeah.
But you can do calculations on stuff and you know, if you apply this law, you know what the result is before you do the calculation.
Yeah.
You know that. And things like frequency and measuring that in the quantum realm, like that is a real thing. That
absolutely.
You try to explain that to people, they'd be like, what the fuck are you on about?
Yeah.
And things like astrology and even studying the stars and the planets and how fucking cycles work with the planets and all that that goes on. If you try to sit down and explain that to people, you'd be like, what are you talking about? What are you talking about? You're my geeky and nerd and all.
I love
and
you're like, your head no, is going.
This is the science.
Calvin gets sassy when he gets
it. Well, I'm saying, this is the science that's behind it.
Yeah.
What you're talking about. You're talking about the universe as a living entity and how the universe is expanding and the Big Bang Theory and all this is there. People have studied it. But if you try to explain that to someone, they'd be like, I just want to sit in me gaff and wish I was richer.
Yeah, and wish for €1 million tomorrow. Or actually, if I write that down 333 times, I'll get it. And look,
I just want to get this one out. Someone text me, you're doing it wrong. That's why it's not working for you.
Ah, you see, that's another reason I wrote the book.
Right?
Seriously, it is another
Now I can see you getting annoyed, is it?
No, that's another reason I wrote the book. Because basically, that then, so if somebody's vulnerable, they're kind of believing in it, right? They are vulnerable because, you know, and they're believing in it and they're doing everything they're supposed to do and bad thing keeps happening. You know, shit keeps happening. Look, the fact of the matter is shit happens.
Yeah.
You know, it shit happens. How you respond to what happens is within your control, but something bad happening may not necessarily be in your control. You know, people die. That's awful. That isn't because you're manifesting stuff wrong. That isn't, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's just something that happens. How you respond to these things. What I want to go back to is, if we go to the quantum mechanics, to quantum physics, I'm not a physicist, okay? And I struggle to understand. The things that happen in the quantum world are crazy. Something's either there or not there, depending on whether you look at it.
We had this conversation about neurons.
No.
If you look at them, they act a certain way. And if you don't look at them, they act a different way.
Yeah. Right. So I'm with most people. It's quite hard to get your head around.
Yeah.
But what I can get my head around and what I try to explain in the book is, yes, everything actually is vibrating. It's subatomic particles.
Yes.
We are made up of subatomic particles, right? So people who do quantum physics research, etc., that's what they understand. That's what they're looking at is the behavior of subatomic particles. Now, quantum physics is physics for tiny things. We're big things. I feel like Father Ted now.
Yeah, far.
We're big things. And the things we try to manifest are also big things. Yes, we are ultimately made up of subatomic particles, but they're all interacting. And once that happens, we start to behave in the way of classical physics. So this chair at subatomic level, the subatomic particles that make up this chair vibrate, okay? But this is in the classical world. This is solid. The floor is solid. I'm solid. We don't behave in the same way because we're big things. Now, the thing is, and this is what I looked into, the thing is, the scientists have not figured out how you can test a subatomic particle in the classical world. Do you know what I mean? The science, and this is the way I said it in the book, the science is not there yet to test the things that people are saying are happening. So I'll just be totally honest. The law of attraction, it definitely explains things that happen in the world. How many times have you thought about something and then the next thing you see it, right?
It's like opening your subconscious mind, is it?
No, right? Okay, so it's describing something that can happen, a phenomenon that can happen. It did not happen because your thoughts vibrated at a certain level, went out to the universe and the universe said, I'm going to
I'll do that for you.
Into here. Just you know, not the other billions and billions of people in the world. Anyway, what actually does happen is that when you, and this is where things like clarity in manifesting make sense. Your brain, now this will take me a little while to explain, so just bear with me.
No problem.
Your brain is bombarded by billions of bits of information every day. Okay? Brilliant as it is, it can't process all of that information. Your brain would explode, for want of an unscientific way to explain it, right? So your brain has to filter in information that's important and relevant to you. Your brain's primary function is to keep you alive. So the main information it will filter in is anything that is going to threaten your survival, right? That's why no matter if you're doing anything and there's a screeching car or whatever, your brain's filtering that in straight away, you know, and you'll jump aside or whatever. It'll then kind of filter in things that maybe have an unusual pattern that are out of the ordinary. So like actually, you know, if you're walking along and suddenly there's four Jeeps driving along with a radio station's logo on the side. Oh, that's unusual. That's different, right? After that, really, it will filter in any information that your behavior, your thinking, your beliefs deem important. Okay, so if you are a person who believes that bad things always happen to you, your brain knows that's important to you. You keep saying it. So your brain is going to go, oh, look, there's another bad thing. There's another bad thing. There's another bad thing. Optimists believe that good things happen to them. So the brain filters in, oh, there's a good thing. There's another good thing. There's another good thing. Okay. Now, if you gain clarity about what you want to manifest, and you visualize it and you go into all that detail, we can talk about that, you know, as we go on, if you wish. You now have given your brain clarity. So the example I use in my book, right, is that years ago, when I was saving to buy a house, because we didn't have big fancy weddings like people have now. The cost actually more than probably my house did, my first house did. Anyway, we were saving to buy a house. We were driving around in an old banger of a car. There was no such thing as an NCT. And we were saving every penny and we were on small enough salaries, right? And it was a Fiat Ritmo, silver one. Actually literally went on fire in traffic one day. The flame started to come out of the engine. So we needed to buy another car, another secondhand car, right? So I knew nothing about cars, but this is important to me because how much money are we going to have to spend out of our savings for this car? So back then, it's way before the internet, back then cars were advertised in the newspaper and there was little photos of whatever. My husband said to me, he said, look, listen, I think we should look for a Mazda 323. He said, they seem to be a good car. They seem to last, you know, a long time and we could get it for a good price. And I said, what's a Mazda 323 like when it's at home? And so he showed me a picture. Next day, I'm going to work, never having known what a Mazda 323 is. And all I can see is, oh, there's a Mazda. Oh, there's another Mazda 323. There's another Mazda 323. They were in traffic all along. I didn't attract them into my world. I didn't actually sort of manifest them into my world. For, you know, basically they were there all along, but now my brain knows Mazda 323s are very important to Sabina. There's one, there's another one, there's another one. So that's what happens when you just have that thing where I'm only thinking about such and such, and then you see it on the street. So your brain is filtering in information that's always there. And this is really important because people don't realize how much their thinking and their beliefs influence their reality. People often think there is just this independent reality. Okay? What I'm seeing is all there is. That is not true. Your perceptions, how you view the world, shapes the reality that you experience. Now, that sounds a bit airy-fairy until you actually kind of, there's a brilliant experiment that shows it. If you are a negative person, you're going to be blind to the amazing positive things that could be happening in your life, the opportunities that can be right in front of your face, right? You can literally miss an opportunity that is there, okay? And there's a brilliant experiment that shows this, okay? It's fantastic. And people may have seen it, but it really shows it how you can miss something when you're focused on something else. So basically, the experiment is set outside a lift and it's two groups of people, one in white t-shirts, one in black t-shirts, and they have a basketball. And so it's a video people are shown. So participants are invited in to view the video and they're given an instruction. Count how many times the players in the white t-shirts pass the ball to each other. Okay. You've seen it, right? But it illustrates it brilliantly. Count the number of times, okay? So they count the number of times, etc. In the middle of it, the lift door opens, a person in a gorilla suit gets out, looks right, looks left, beats their chest, and then walks off. The gorilla suited person is on screen for a total of 9 seconds, okay? Now, pretty much, I can't remember the stats. Yes, pretty much everybody gets the number of passes correct. That's what people are focused on, they're blinkered on. And somebody like me would be so competitive. I'm not getting this wrong, you know? And then when they say, what about, or something, the question is something like, how long was the gorilla on screen? And 50% of people say, what gorilla, right? Now that illustrates it. And in some regards, that's not bad. Focused attention can be good. It can keep you on track. But it also demonstrates that if you're only focused on one thing or, you know, you can really, really miss opportunities. And I think another thing that's kind of really interesting about manifesting, because it's presented as if it's this, the fact that you said some people say, oh, you're doing it wrong. It's presented as if it's something that you have to learn how to do. Now, that's why I think what people refer to as manifesting should be referred to as conscious manifesting, because we are manifesting our life, our reality, every single day of our life, right? But we're doing it unconsciously, okay? So you're getting up, you're doing things. So without focus, you're just kind of often just following along, or, you know, you're doing whatever. But in order to do anything, manifesting just means to make something happen, to make it happen. So if you want to have a shower, you make it happen. You change your reality. You go from here sitting in the chair. Now, I don't know if there's a shower down in the bathroom there, but there, So if you want to have a shower, you actually change your reality from one moment to the next. One minute you're chatting to me in the studio, the next minute you're in a shower. Now, you didn't magically make that happen. You took action, you took the steps, and you changed your reality. Now, we're doing that all the time, but often it's unconscious around what we're doing. The thing about manifesting techniques and steps, one of the steps a lot of people, manifesting gurus and books, start with is gain clarity about what you want. Okay, visualize your goals. And as I said, visualizing really works. You know, it's what surgeons do to practice surgery before they go in. They keep visualizing it over and over and over again. There's loads of science behind the fact that that works. But when you visualize something, you're visualizing the end result. Your brain is brilliant at solving what's called inverse problems, whereby it knows the answer and then it can work its way back to the steps to get there, right? So you visualize what you want. Your brain can gradually work back, get the steps. They're the steps. They're the actions you have to take to achieve your goal. Whether it's you want a six pack, you know, what do I have to do? I have to go to the gym 2 hours, you know, 5 days a week. I have to do X number of sit-ups, X number of this, that, and the other. You have your action and your steps. So gaining clarity as well around things that you may want, your brain can start to filter in potential opportunities or things that are relevant. Or you might hear something in a conversation, or someone might say something to you and you're attuned to that, oh, that might help work for that. And a lot of the other little manifesting, so I divide them into manifesting steps and techniques. So the techniques, things like affirmations will keep you on target. Things like vision boards will keep you on track. So all those little things help you to stay focused on your goal, and you have clarity about what you want. So I suppose what would help actually is a definition that I think really works well in terms of describing what manifesting is. So manifesting, yes, it is transforming thought into reality by visualizing your goals. And that's often where a lot of them stop.
Yeah.
But it continues. And developing the discipline to stay focused on and take action to attain those goals. So it's the discipline and the focus and the action that are missing from a lot of things. You know, you can't magically make things happen. You can't defy physics, but you can change your future. You can change your reality. You can achieve your goals.
Yeah.
you know? I think it's, yeah, I mean, that's what I wanted. And one thing I did want to say is that, so most of those start with clarity, but what I felt was that's actually jumping the gun, that there's a lot more foundational work that needs to happen before you do that.
Yeah.
And so the steps I kind of have is really, compassion is step one. You have to learn to, you have to learn self-compassion. Then you have to connect with and understand who you really are. And that's a biggie. And I can talk about both of those. And then it's understanding that manifesting is about change. And change requires action and it requires you to do things. At that point, then you can get your clarity. And then there's what I call cohesion, because mine are all begin with the letter C. In manifesting, they'll call it alignment. And that's really just making sure that your vision is aligned with your values, with your thinking, with your behaving, and with your action. Because if any of them aren't aligned, you're not going to kind of achieve your goal. And then I have a final step sort of, which is then you can create your reality using the various techniques, you know?
Yeah. The first two you mentioned there were...
Yeah, I think they're actually the most important things, really, to be honest.
What do you mean by that? By self-compassion and finding out who you are? And...
Yeah, okay. And these do take work. So you understand what compassion is when you're compassionate to someone else. But we're rarely compassionate towards ourselves. In fact, we're generally quite the opposite. We all have that voice in our head and it's a very critical voice.
Yeah.
So what I actually say in the book is, look, you need to start to accept that self-criticism is a form of self-harm. Okay. It's as bad as, in a way, as cutting yourself, because the psychological damage. So if you talk about anyone who's been in an abusive situation or has had a traumatized childhood, you do understand that the psychological and emotional abuse can often actually be more damaging and last longer than physical harm that happened. So the kind of abuse that self-criticism is, it's that psychological abuse. It's telling yourself you're useless, you're no good, all those sorts of things. Now, the way I say it, and I give talks on this topic, is imagine your friend is started a new relationship and you're out with them and their new partner starts to talk to them the way you talk to yourself in your head. What would you do? You'd call them over and you'd say, hold on a second, don't let them talk to you like that. That's rotten. They're putting you down all the time. They're criticizing everything you say. And we do that to ourselves all the time. We wouldn't dare talk to someone else the way we talk to ourselves. And a lot of those are kind of patterns of thinking that we've learned. So we can switch them up and we can start treating ourselves with a bit more compassion. Like, making mistakes is absolutely critical for manifesting your dreams, because that's how we learn. You know, making a mistake isn't a failure. And failing isn't the end of the world. You have to fail in order to try again. You know, that's how our behavior is shaped. That's how you teach a child how to score a goal. You know, if their first shot goes 10 foot wide, you don't say, well, you failed, no point in trying anymore. Do you know? You go, okay, that went a bit that way. What about if you try your foot this way? Yay, you got it only 3 foot away from the goal. You're getting nearer. That's how we learn as humans. We constantly try, fail, adapt, try, fail. But somehow we've developed this voice in our head that doesn't allow for that. And we beat ourselves up and we echo things that maybe other people said to us. So learning to treat yourself with kindness is quite challenging, especially if you grew up in our country, you know. I mean, a lot of Americans kind of, oh, you got to love yourself and, you know, all those kind of things. I mean, when I grew up, I don't know if it was the same when you were growing up, but if you said, Jesus, he loves himself, you know, it meant he was an asshole, you know. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's kind of hard for us. And I mean, I grew up as well, like with my dad sort of saying things like self-praise is no praise.
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
you know, you got to be modest. And, you know, so we have this whole, you know, shaping of our behavior that it's not good, that now manifests us as, you know, manifests as us being critical of ourselves. So yeah. I think kind of the very first step to making any progress is to start to be kinder to yourself and to start to talk to yourself. So replace that dialogue, you know, that I never know if it's a dialogue, a monologue. Sometimes I think I have a dialogue where I'm actually arguing with myself in my head. But yes, it's actually to sort it. And a real trick is just to say, okay, if say you've made a mistake or you've really screwed up on something, or you know, you had a few drinks and you feckin' slept with someone you didn't mean to and you're going to beat yourself up forever. Imagine it's your best friend. You know, what would you say? You'd say, well, look, yeah, okay, you didn't want to do that. You shouldn't have done it. It's done. It's gone. No point in beating yourself up. What can you do maybe to stop that happening again? And don't be so hard on yourself. We need to start kind of treating ourselves a bit more that way. And I think the really interesting thing from all this kind of research delving into this is, so one thing I say to people is, so if you are visualizing or trying to figure out, gain clarity about what you want, I would say to people, you know, because, you know, people are free to decide what it is they want. Some people just want material, and I shouldn't say just, some people want material things. They want money or they want a big car or whatever. Other people want different things. They want to find love or, you know, various things. But what I say is you got to keep asking yourself, but why? You know, but why do you want that Gucci bag? But why? But why? And you'll eventually get to a point where there's no more but whys. And it's usually because it'll make me happy, right? That's usually the ultimate goal of humans. Whatever we do, it'll make us happy. The really interesting thing is one of the key benefits of self-compassion is happiness. So people who are compassionate towards themselves are happier and more content than people who aren't. So I say, straight up, straight away, be kind to yourself. You're going to feel happier. You asked me then about the second thing about connecting with yourself. And I think this is really, really important. How can you know what you want if you have no idea who you are? And a lot of us don't know who we are. Now, maybe I'm exposing a lot about myself, but I think a lot of people don't really know who they are. And what I try to explain...
In what sense, Sabina? What do you mean by that?
What I mean is, I suppose the best way I can describe it is who you are, your personality, who you think you are is a collection of beliefs, patterns of behavior. Do you know what I mean? I'm like, how would you describe Calvin?
Literally, I was about to say that. It's how would you expect someone to describe it?
Yeah.
If you have to write it down, I'm not going to give you a name. I'm going to write these attributes down about a person. Tell me who it is.
Yeah. So that's kind of sort of, you have a sense of self behind your eyes, for want of a better word. You have a sense of the Terrence that exists here in my head, okay? And then you have behaviors that this Terrence behaves this way with these people and that way with other people. But you have a sense that there's a you behind
your
eyes.
An overall.
Yeah, a Terrence who's always there. Mm. But that's a little trick of your brain, because your sense of self, who you are, is not fixed. It's constantly changing, but it feels fixed, right? Because the changes happen over time. And the only way that you can really see it, if I was to compare Sabina at 35 with Sabina at 15, we're completely different people, you know? And you're nowhere near what you were at 5. Yes, there may be traits and tendencies that are still there, but the sense of who you are changes. Now, the thing is that sense of who you are is just a story made up by your brain from available data. Okay? So the story of you, who you are, I'm an idiot, I'm no good at maths, I'm brilliant at running, I'm whatever, I'm short-tempered, I'm very jolly, you know, whatever those things are. So it's just a story. I could just call it the story of you. So your brain has created this sense of self, this story of you, from data available to it. Right? A lot of that data is ancient. How many things do you hold on to about yourself now that are from something that someone said to you when you were 7 years old? I know I still have some stuff where teachers said something to me that really hurt or really mattered. And your brain has taken that in because it was important, because it had an emotional response or it upset you or whatever and said, oh, that's important. You know, that's part of who you are. And the thing is, it's a collection of all these things. And the reason it's really important in terms of manifesting is that a lot of those beliefs that we have about ourselves are limiting beliefs. They're the things that stop us achieving what we want to achieve. I know I'll never be good at that. I know I could never write a book. I was never good at English. You know?
Yeah.
So, and that's funny, actually. I've just said that, but I was never particularly good at English. And I suppose in my head, you know, for a long time, I would have thought, oh, I could never write a book. Yeah. Do you know? But I suppose what I'm trying to say is that second chapter where connecting with yourself, who you really are, it's kind of an exercise in sort of sitting down with yourself and write. So you just said it, writing down about another person. Write all the things down about who you are and what you believe and those things that make up the story of you, and actually test their validity. The thing is, your brain, when it collects this data and information, it doesn't test whether it's true, whether it's valid, whether maybe it was once true, because a lot of the stuff might have been true at one point, but is no longer true. It's obsolete, you know. So basically, I think it's really important exercise to actually look at who you are or who you think you are or that story of you and start questioning, well, where did I get that from? Where did I get that? There's a woman in the book that I refer to, and I interviewed her. She's a journalist in the UK, and she's also an author of a brilliant book. But anyway, she had this thing in her head, I'm crap at maths, never been good at maths. So she also felt, I'm crap at money. She had another story that kind of fed into why she felt she was crap at money. And so she was never good at money. She never had any money. And to the extent when she got an advance for her first book, she spent it straight away because she thought people would take it back, because she said, you never get to keep money. You know, she had that thing. Then years later, actually quite recently, and this woman is in her 40s now, she was helping her mother move house. So all her life, crap at money. She was helping her mum to move house. And as they were clearing out the attic, as you do, you find the old school copybooks and the old school reports, the bits that were kept. She's top of the class in maths. She has no idea where she got it. She doesn't know where she got the idea that she was bad at maths. But there was the fact, as you said, it was untrue. But she, that little piece of information, wherever it came from, stuck with her, and it had become part of who she was and had influenced a lot of things in her life, and it wasn't true. So we all have loads of stuff like that, stuff that has stopped us from doing things or stuff that has sent us to behave in a different way. The thing is, you're the author of your story. You can rewrite it. And that's not pretending you're something that you're not, but it is sort of interrogating something and say, where did I get that from? That was like, often we're living off one person's opinion, something someone said to you once, and you've taken that in and on board. So you can change that.
Oh, you failed English. Doesn't stop me doing 3+ episodes of a podcast a week.
Yeah.
I'm only messing.
No, it's true.
So that, what you were talking about there, I wanted to ask what the science was behind this question. So, you know, you often hear the mental block. You often hear the people running the marathon, they hit the wall.
Yeah.
You used a good example there, comparing the Irish with Americans.
Yeah.
So one example we'll always give is that if you had an American up-and-coming boxer, you'd interview him after a second point and say, what's your goal? And he's like, I'm going to be world champion. Yeah. Everyone's like, fucking right you are. But if you had an Irish one, you'd be like, what's your goal? And if he says, I'm going to be world champion, everyone would be like, he's only had 2 fights.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's that mental block. And you're saying, the lady you interviewed, she, in her head, it's like, oh, I'm bad at maths. So
yeah, yeah.
Her actions will make her bad at maths.
Oh, absolutely. There's kind of that self-fulfilling prophecy, really, in a way. Your brain can be quite obedient, you know, and it'll kind of...
Yeah, so that's what I was like, the mental block thing.
Yeah.
Is that a real, like, scientific thing that if your brain's like, I can't picture us getting past this point, we're not going past this point.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So really, so that's kind of the negative perspective. The best way I can refer to that is in the positive. Like, so you get in your own way. So say someone who says, oh, I'm crap. I cannot get up on stage. Don't make me present that. I'm absolutely awful. I can't, right? So that's going to set off your stress response. That's going to get in your way of your ability to think clearly, to actually do the thing. Your mouth will get dry. You're setting yourself up to fail. However, those things like positive affirmations, I can do this, I can really do this, eventually you can start to train yourself to believe that you can do it. Simply changing how you stand, adopting a confidence pose. You see, people forget that your brain takes information in from the outside world, and that influences you. But your brain also takes information in from your body. So if you're like, it's Madonna, strike a pose. You know, if you stand confidently, your brain will start to go, no, okay.
It's the Superman pose. Confident. Remember, you just always slap me over the Superman pose in the mirror. That's it.
Yeah.
I've heard that before. If you're going to give a presentation, go into the bathroom and stand in the Superman pose.
Yeah. Yeah. I do think it's a real challenge. I mean, I've said it in the book. I do think it's a real challenge being Irish because you kind of get laughed at for doing that kind of stuff. But given the amount of self-help books there are everywhere, I still think it's a challenge for more than just Irish people, do you know?
Yeah.
They maybe Americans are able to say it, but maybe they don't really believe it because you have to believe it. So like, and it really does matter because again, it influences. And I'm actually really trying to work on this myself. But for years I look in the mirror, you know, and all I'll see is the lines and I'm getting older and we live in an age of society where you're supposed to be young and thin and, you know, everything perfect. And so I look in the mirror and my brain is focusing on the lines and the bits of grey hair coming through or whatever. My husband gets up in the morning. Now, my husband left school at 15, whatever, group cert or whatever. He's never read any of my books. Basically, he gets up in the morning. He puts on a suit. He gets himself ready. He stands in front of the mirror and says, you're looking good. Do you know, he just does it naturally. Do you know, he just has that ability to, it's kind of talking yourself up. It's acting as if. So that's another technique in manifesting. Fake it till you make it. Act as if. Now, that's not a license to, you know, act as if you're a physicist and you're not, or act as if, you know, you can run a marathon and you can't. But what it is it's faking it till you make it. And it can apply to really, really everyday mundane things, like the amount of people who say, oh God, and I do believe this, getting up earlier in the morning, you can get much more out of your day. You know, you can achieve an awful lot before other people have even started their day. You're kind of ahead of the game. But a lot of people say, oh God, no, I wish I was an early riser, you know, but I just can't get out of the bed. Act as if you're an early riser. How do you act as if you're an early riser? You do what an early riser does. They go to bed early. They set their alarm to get up in the morning. When the alarm goes off, they don't hit snooze. They get out of bed. This sounds really stupid, but that's what acting as if is. Do what, you know, the thing is, do what an early riser does. And the thing is, with time, if you keep doing that for a few weeks, actually, you will automatically be an early riser because you've trained your brain into the routine and the habit. And you'll just kind of get up. Now, having said that, and there's always a having said that, you know, we do have set points, you know, between being night owls and larks. Isn't that it? Yeah, night owls, early risers and night owls. And that actually changes across our lifespan as well. So, you know, you could be in your 20s a real night owl, but then by your 50s and 60s, you become an early bird.
Why is that? Why do all like owl ones and elf lists, they're up out of bed at 5 and 6 in the morning every morning, doing the bleeding washing?
Yeah, so here's my theory. And this is just my theory. There isn't scientific research. But if you think about it, okay, so bear in mind that our brains have been evolving for millions of years, okay? Modern society that we live in with electric light and computers and all that sort of stuff, it's a blip. You know, it's a couple of minutes in terms of those millions of years, right? So you think we're living in the wild, we're, you know, we're either living in caves or whatever, sleeping under the stars, and we're vulnerable to predators. We have to sleep. Our brain needs sleep. It's the way we have evolved. Our brain has really important work to do when we're asleep. It doesn't make an iota of sense for all of a tribe or a group of people to go asleep at the same time so that the feckin' other tribe or your enemy or the lions and tigers can come in and tackle y'all. So it makes sense to me that we would sleep in staggered phases. So it makes sense that the young guns up to 25 and 27 are hanging out and finding it comfortable to stay up till 3 and 4 in the morning. And that then the older people are starting to wake up at 5 in the morning. You can have constant people awake and alert looking after the group. You know, we work in social groups. That's my theory. I haven't ever tested it, but it makes sometimes the simple, but it makes sense, doesn't it? Yeah. Like, it really does make sense. And that's why it also makes sense then that that changes over time, over our lifespans. Mm. You know, you might be a night owl now, but then when you're 60 or 70, you'll be going, oh, feck it. 5 o'clock and I'm awake. But I give talks to older people about aging well. I give talks to young people about how to age well. And the thing is, a lot of people, older people, will sort of say to me, oh, I'm just so tired all the time because I'm awake at bloody 5 o'clock in the morning and, you know, I'm missing out on my sleep. And I'm going, that's your cycle. Your body rhythm has changed now. Your circadian rhythm is going to wake you up. You're going to get your cortisol spike to get you out of bed at 5 o'clock in the morning. What time are you going to bed? Oh, the same time as I always did. The same time you went to bed when your cortisol spike was getting you up at 8 o'clock in the morning. What was that? 12 o'clock. No, you need to actually pull back and start going to bed at 9 or 10 at night. Mm. So then when you wake up at 5 in the morning, you'll feel fresh. Because just because you wake at, older people wake at 5 o'clock in the morning doesn't mean they need less sleep. They maybe need about an hour less once you hit 65, but you still need your 8 hours.
Yeah.
So I'm not putting myself in that category, but I have started to go to bed earlier because I want to get more out of the mornings. Now, I'm completely different in the winter.
Yeah,
I'm completely different in the winter.
Because yeah, I can't sleep in the night and I'm up. And my missus only said to me yesterday, we woke up and it was 7:05. She goes, it feels good waking up and not seeing a 6 on the clock for a change. I'm up at 6 o'clock every morning by yesterday. And I think it's because of the sun.
Oh no, it's the weather. But it makes sense. You know, our body is full of clocks. You know, that's why it's really important to get out in daylight every day to reset, you know, your body operates on all these clocks and rhythms. And what we've done with electric light and all those things is we're forcing our brain to behave in a way that goes against our natural rhythm. So I kind of feel, well, look, in the summertime, I'm full of energy, you know, and I am going to wake up early in the morning. And I hear the birds singing and whatever. They're waking up early in the morning. In the wintertime, I think I need more sleep. I do get a little bit depressed. But the way I look at that, I think as well, so we have this thing sad, and I'm not dismissing it. I definitely kind of get, I definitely feel down in the wintertime, you know, and I have to work hard to kind of keep my mood up in the winter.
Good prescription for that is 2 weeks in Tenerife in January, isn't it?
There you go. Yeah. Well, yeah, that would do that. But also, again, I think it kind of makes sense. I think maybe we're over-medicalizing what is normal human behavior, that in the wintertime we go into like semi-hibernation, you know, because if you think back, did it make sense to head out in the pitch black and go hunting? No, because our night vision isn't as good as our predator's night vision. So that again makes sense to me that we kind of, you know, that our whole sort of energy levels and our need for sleep increases. That makes sense to me. Yeah. How so many animals hibernate for the winter, and we're animals. And I think that's it. And I think in a way as well, it's the pressure of society and our culture and the books we read and the films that we watch tell us that we should never feel depressed, that we should always feel happy. And I kind of question that and kind of go, maybe we should accept, hey, that's how I feel in the winter. How can I manage this? Instead of feeling, I have to fight it.
Yeah.
I have to fight it.
Like, depression can be a good thing if you understand why you're depressed.
Yeah.
So like, I was chatting to a friend today. Now, friends, he's only back off of stags. He's like, oh, I'm depressed in my head. I was like, yeah.
Well, that'd be the alcohol.
Oh, exactly. I was like, yeah, you had to be on a session for 3 days.
Yeah, that's the alcohol.
I was like, you're not sleeping, you're not eating, you have to drink and whatever. I was like, that's why you're depressed. And as long as you are aware of this is why I'm depressed, this is why I feel that way, then that's a positive. You're like, no, right, I know how to prevent this now.
Yeah,
going forward.
Don't
do that.
No, absolutely. And that's what I think. So you see, it's normal to feel depressed in response to certain situations. And it's normal, I think, as well. Like, you know, it's normal to be, grief is normal. It's painful. You know, it's normal to feel depressed after something like that happens. A grief. And yet we hand out pills for people to stop feeling that grief. Now, that can serve a purpose if it's, you know, overwhelming for someone. But I remember doing research when I was doing my PhD. I used to have to ask all of our participants what medication they were on and to bring it in. And the amount of older adults who were on antidepressants, and I'd say, because they'd have answered a thing, you know, questionnaire about whether they were depressed or anxious or whatever, because they, you know, it impacted on the research. And I would say, oh, why are you on this medication? And you say, oh, when my husband died, the doctor put me on that. And sure, he said, there's no point in taking me off it. And I'd say, how long ago was that? Oh, 10 years ago. And you kind of go, you know, no. So yes, they can really serve a purpose. And also antidepressants and all those medications when people have severe, I am not saying that mental illness isn't there, etc. But I'm talking about these experiences that we have. Feeling anxious it serves a purpose, you know? If we feel anxious, it's our body, maybe our brain, maybe noticing something that's a little off, and it's just setting us on alert. It's when those things become chronic or, you know, or misdirected or you know, debilitating, that you go into the realm of it being mental illness. But I think there's a real danger now of us saying that depression is bad and anxiety is bad. They can serve purposes, and they've evolved for a reason, and they persist for a reason. But, you know, grief is painful and it can take years, but you come out. That's where resilience comes from. You know, coming, like, you can feel depressed, but it doesn't have to stop you living.
Yeah.
Doing things. Now, I'm not talking about clinical depression when you've gone way down. I'm just talking the everyday stuff.
You're feeling something.
You're feeling something. Yeah. You're feeling something. And as you just said, and I actually hate what you just, when you said that to me, I cannot stand if I wake up in a morning with that horrible, uneasy feeling in my gut and feeling a bit depressed after I've had... been at a party and drank loads. That really annoys me, because I say, you think you were having a great time last night, but you just screwed yourself up today. You feel horrible. And I'm not talking about a hangover. I'm talking about that whole horrible inside-y feeling. And I'm, like you were just saying to your friend, I'm kind of taking that as a message to say, well, don't drink that much again. It's not good for you. It messes, you know, with stuff.
You're reacting to something that's happening in your environment. It's not like, this is my life now. I'm just sad all the time. It's like, no, you've done something and now this is how you feel.
And the same as in the winter time. You know, I had a bad winter last year in terms of feeling really down. Now, I know that kicked off because my son nearly died in September. And that was really, really traumatic. And when I say nearly died, I mean, literally, ended up having to have life-saving open stomach surgery, the whole shebang. He was just bleeding out and they kept... giving him transfusions, and he was just still bleeding out. So that kind of hit me much worse than I realized it did. Do you know what I mean? And I did feel kind of depressed quite a lot over the winter. In hindsight, now I'm out the other side. I'm kind of going, you know what? That was a trauma.
Yeah.
That was a real trauma I experienced, even though he's grown up and he's in his 30s and all the rest. And I think that kind of set me off into what I'd call a bad place. And again, that colours your perception of reality. It coloured what I was doing and how I felt about stuff. But exactly what you're saying, for me, and this is why actually the changes in seasons are wonderful, the minute I start, and that's why things like present-mindedness and noticing what's going on in your surroundings are so important. Because for me, where I live, I started to see the snowdrops coming up, and then I start to see the leaves coming up. And that starts to let me feel like, oh, yes, this is a cycle again. Do you know that kind of way? Mm. But I also know that I don't want that to happen again next year, right? So I'm thinking I need to put a few things in place so that I don't let myself get as far down as I did. Because other years I haven't. Other years, you know, it's been fine. But for me, the thing that I could identify was that something big happened that impacted my mood. And I think, again, that's going back to you saying, and to me saying, why it's really important to connect with who you are and self-awareness, understanding. Like for me, that's a very important thing, to have the self-awareness that, you know, I can be vulnerable to depression in the winter time. So be aware of that, put things in place, or, you know, even say to someone like, I could say to my husband and say, you know what, you know, don't let me drink too much if such and such, because I don't want to kind of trigger off. And we can all do that, like kind of talk to people. But I do think self-awareness, if you want to manifest, you really have to kind of get to know yourself and understand who you are and understand your values, your core values. Because if you are visualizing a goal that is completely opposed or against your values, it's either not going to happen, or you're going to achieve it and feel very uncomfortable in the place you got to. So we all kind of have core values, things, lines we won't cross, things that really matter to us. So that exercise of connecting with yourself is really important, to find out what really matters to you. Because most people, what you find is they're mid-40s and they kind of go, how'd I get here? Why am I, you know, why did I keep applying for all those promotions? I don't even like this job. It's not what I wanted to do when I was a kid. Do you know? And that's a way I say to people, look, if you really don't know what you'd really like, go, you know, or I always try to say to people, when you do that exercise of figuring out who you are, try and find what your passion is. Because if you can make your passion your job or part of your goal, attaining your goal is going to be so much easier. And then a lot of people go, I don't know. And I think a really, really good way to gain insight into that is to go back to when you were a kid. What did you absolutely love doing? What was it that you did where you wouldn't hear anyone calling you? You wouldn't even be hungry. You were just kind of lost in it. And that can be a real little indicator as to what direction you might want to go in. Yeah. Now, you might find that it was something mad, like, you know, kicking the ball, you know, doing your, what do you call those? What, there used to be a name from how many times? Keepy-uppies.
Yeah.
Keepy-uppies. I knew it was a complex name. But it can point you in a direction. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it might be that you loved drawing. Now, maybe there's no chance that you could be an artist, but maybe it gives you an indication, well, okay, I kind of like to be in a profession that is a bit more creative than the one I'm in. Do you know what I mean? Just kind of give you little pointers. And you've only one life. That's the way I feel it. You've only one life. Don't waste it just because you got to X point. And I think that's it. A lot of us measure success by what society says is successful. And I think that's a recipe for disaster, because society is so focused on monetary success. Now, I'm not saying money doesn't matter. I could do with a bit more of it myself. I really could. Thanks to Mr. Trump, loads of my talks have just stopped coming in, because a lot of the budgets are under the diversity, equity and inclusion. And so people, you know, aren't paying me to give talks. But why did I even say that? Yes, sorry. Money. It's easy to turn around and say, look, money doesn't make people happy. Money, there is a relationship between money and happiness up to the point where you have enough to eat, a roof over your head, you know, you can clothe your kids or whatever, right? But once you get beyond that into the riches and riches and riches, there's no relationship between the amount of money you have and how happy you are. Just look at loads of billionaires. Look at, I won't mention names, but, you know, look at people who get fame and fortune and, you know, they still feel depressed. And, you know, I think that, like, the real happiness comes from, you know, if you're doing something that you're passionate about and gives you that sense of, for me, like, it matters. What I do has to matter. It has to make a difference.
That's what I wanted to ask you. Are you doing what you feel?
Yeah. I do what I'm passionate about. I mean, as a child,
Because it sounds like hard work what you do. Writing books.
Yeah, it is
lots
hard
of research,
work. No, it is.
Talks, public speaking.
No, that's hard. That's
it's
hard.
All hard work.
No, I like the giving talks bit. I like this bit.
Yeah.
In fact, now I just wrote two books, one after the other. And the last book I wrote was actually hard. Even reading it today kind of was hard because my own mum had dementia. So I don't just use the neuroscience. I use my own experience. Yeah, that brought up lots of kind of memories. So yes, I revisit every so often. I think that's really important as well. So so if I go back to my childhood, all I ever wanted to be was an actor. That's all I ever wanted to be. That's what I played. I played games where I was this person or that person, or I'd set up the whole scene. I was probably the director as well as the actor. And then I studied acting from the age of 8, and that's all I ever wanted to do. But my parents thought that, don't be silly, people aren't actors, you know? And that's Ireland going back a long time ago. I didn't know ordinary people could be actors, do you know? And then I did become, when I had my own kids, I said, feck it. You know, I better try and follow my own dreams. And I did become an actor, and I love being an actor, and I was an actor in Fair City. And then I went to study psychology, and I thought I would do that as a temporary thing and then do my acting along. And then I kind of discovered that I absolutely adore the psychology, and I love that, you know, figuring it out. And I have much more control over my life than you have when you're an actor, you know, because it depends on whether you get a part or not. Yeah. You can't stand at home.
Unemployment rate, that.
Yeah, high unemployment rate. And especially for women, much more than men. So 2017, I was directing, you know, going back then, I was directing a dementia research program, doing a lot of heavy research and all the rest. And I was just being too many directions, 16 hours a day and all the rest. And so I did that thing. I don't know if I said it to you the last time, but I think it's really useful. You write down all the things you are and all the things you do, and you basically kind of write opposite them, you know, why you do it and how much you love doing it. And then you really can find the things that you do that you really don't enjoy, and you kind of go, why am I doing it? So I kind of did that in about 2017, and I kind of stopped doing stuff, and I've gradually kind of come to where I am. I'm not earning as much money as I would. In fact, actually, at the moment, I'm not really earning any money. But I'm happy doing what I'm doing. But I now have to look, and maybe we'll have to take redirection if, you know, this impact that Trump is having on us who speak in that kind of sphere. I may have to revisit, you know, well, how am I going to get income in? But I'm not prepared to give up what I'm doing. Yeah. I think in ways I kind of be more likely to tighten my belt a bit more so I can keep doing this, because I know this makes me happy. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think there's a good industry in if you went into what real manifestation is. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think because
I like my book.
Yeah, well, if you were to go down that avenue, because I know plenty of people that are in that realm, and
they're making a fortune.
They're making a fortune, yeah. But again, what I loved about what you opened this podcast with is that it's the accountability for your own internal thoughts and actions that you have to take.
It's your own values, you see.
Yeah.
That's why I'm talking, that's important. So, and I suppose then what comes into it too, because people have said to me, oh my God, it's been exactly what you've said. Look at these people, and they charge 500 an hour and whatever. You have you have all this kudos behind you. Imagine what you could charge. And so I don't know whether with me, it's part of that Irish thing. Oh God, me charge that much money? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or is it maybe that it doesn't sit right with me? Or I don't know. I haven't got there. Who knows? I might be inviting you in and saying, here's what I do. You know,
need to but
I
am, some more, yeah.
No, I mean, I am doing something. So we moved down the country, as I think I said the last time. And I think we were just renovating cottages to turn into Airbnb. So I've manifested that, manifested my dream home, manifested transforming outbuildings into holiday cottages. And we have an outdoor spa, and it's on a lake. And I feel that's kind of given people, you know, a place to go and kind of find themselves in a way. I will, and what I do ultimately want to do is kind of hold retreats there. And I may also offer people an opportunity, we'll say, that if they come, stay a night, have a night at the spa, the sauna, the hot tub, and if they wanted a one-to-one session, we could do that or have groups or something. I mean, that's there. But at the moment, we're loving having having guest stay. It's luxellandhouse.com, by the way.
Yeah, yeah, right. No, plug it. But like, there is a lot of retreats and there is a lot of stuff like that, which is attached to the early 30s. So, I think if you led on a more scientific approach, there could be a market there. And I think think a lot more people would be.
And you know what's probably holding me back? It's some because what I have to say to people, right? I know all this shit, but I'm human. So I make the same mistakes. I have the same limiting beliefs as other people. I do try and take action and I talk to myself and I'm doing that. But I'm on the same journey that everybody else is on. Well, someone said to me once, and this is going way back when I was doing more of the brain health stuff, and it was a guy in the university. Now, there's loads of guys in, like Luca, you've had Luca Neal on, have you? No, you haven't had him on?
No.
Okay, he's a scientist. He's one of the scientists. He's a microbiologist, I think, where he developed something that's now worth millions. So he no longer has to work. Yes. So I was kind of looking for ways, as I still am, how do I kind of monetize what I do? You know, I need to eat like everybody else. But I also feel like it's funny with me. I love talking to you guys. I'm talking to you guys for free. I love getting the message out there. And I somehow, there's a switch in my head where I need to turn it and say, okay, I got to get paid for this. I'm not asking people. Podcasts.
50 quid each.
No, podcasts don't pay. That's what I love about this genre. You just go on and other people come on yours and all the rest. But have to kind of find a way. But I remember talking to another guy that I know, a professor who also has spin-off companies, they're called. And he said to me, and this is probably in a way holding me back, because he said to me, ah, Sabina, you're an evangelist, not an entrepreneur. And something in me kind of liked the idea. Oh yeah, I'm an evangelist, but geez, I need to look at the evangelists in America. but they generally cheat people or, you know, whatever. So I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I need somebody. I always feel I need somebody to kind of, you do the business side. I'll do this side.
Well, I say when people listen to this, I reckon you'll tickle the fancy of a lot of people. It'll be like, that sounds more like my cup of tea than what else is out.
And sorry to anyone about the law of attraction, but that's the truth. It's not a scientific law.
I always said it, Sabina, from the start, the only person who ever got successful from The Secret is the person who wrote it.
Absolutely.
Sabina, the name of your book is?
Oh, The Neuroscience of Manifesting.
Right.
The Magical Science of Getting the Life You Want.
And is available on audio?
Yes, and I read it. Audio, ebook, and...
all good bookstores.
Ordinary book, all good bookstores. And in fact, the little book version, you know the way it comes out in that size, what do you call it? It's a bigger size anyway, and then it comes out in the ordinary paperback. I have been in a studio all day. I have driven down from Cavan. I have to drive back up again. My brain is not sharp at the moment. But it's actually, there's a new edition is what I should say, coming out in June as well. But it's available online everywhere. Buy it, buy it, buy it. I'll get €1.40 for every book you buy.
Really, Sabina, and else you need to plug while we're here?
No, but I do, people do look at the holiday cottages. They're just a little slice of heaven, and we live in a slice of paradise beside the lake, and we're just an hour from Dublin.
Right.
Luxellandhouse.com. Guys.
You won't get rid of us.
No, come down and show it on your Instagram.
Yeah. Oh, love.
No problem.
Yeah.
Look at it again. What's it called, Hill?
Luxellandhouse.com. So it's luxellandhouse.com. And it actually really is gorgeous.
We look forward to seeing it. 30.
That's it.
Thanks out, Siobhan.
Boom.
That's us for this week. Thanks to the legends at Roy Stoyle Furniture Shop for the support.
Speaking of great support, see what I did there? Roy Stoyle has everything, and I mean everything. Sofa, sorted. Beds, covered. Dining table, 6 chairs, boom, all in one house package. Plus, the lads in the store are sound as well. And if you're more of an online shopper, that's no problem.
Whack in the code GET10 on roystyle.ie and take 10% off whatever you're buying. Free savings. What's not to love?
I'm telling you, don't sleep on this deal. Unless it's on one of the mattresses, in which case, fair play.
Roy Price, Roy Stoyle, right now. Visit www.roystyle.ie and use promo code GET10 for 10% off.
Talking Bollocks, a Go Loud original podcast. Sponsored by Right Style Furniture. Right price, right style, right now. Visit rightstyle.ie.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
Subscribe to this podcast for free on the Go Loud app.
What you waiting for? Put your back in it. Just a little more. Why are you waiting now? Fill your body, your taste.
hip knocker. Go down, go down, go down.